I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is neuroscientist and sexual psychophysiologist Nicole Prousey. And now join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Nicole Prousey. Nicole Prousey is here tonight to talk candidly about the subject of female orgasm in all its complexity. She started her predoctoral work in physiological and brain sciences at the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University right after Viagra had been approved. She then became the lab coordinator for a pioneering clinical trial for a prototype it was hoped would become the Viagra for women. She'll describe how that turned out. A former research scientist at UCLA, where she created Liberos, a company to address what she feels is the inadequate state of research into women's sexuality. She's here tonight to talk about her groundbreaking research. Please welcome Nicole Prousey. Hi, Nicole.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being here.
I appreciate the invitation.
Happy to have you as part of our Uninhibited series. So I'm sure everybody wants to know how you got involved in this line of work. How did you get started?
It is so unsexy. I apologize in advance, but as an undergraduate, you have to take lab credits at some point, and the Kinsey Institute was offering them, and what a better way to get credits out of the way than, in that case, studying the side effects of a menopause drug on women, looking at its sexual side effects. That was my first ever study, so it was this deep end kind of experience. And there is so much yet to do in this field that if you like to, you know, play with computers and do programming and build your own electrical toys and various things, that is exactly the place to be. So that was an initial exposure by fire that just turned into great nerding out.
So the nerding out. And so the place to be is studying women's sexuality. Is that what you're saying? Is that the field that is so wide open? I'm sorry. This is gonna happen
all night long. I can see.
I'm telling you right now. But that's what you're saying, right?
Sexuality generally, actually, there's quite a lot yet to be known about men as well, I think. But women, we lagged behind for a long time. In some ways, we've now surpassed some of the information we have for men, but it's been a back and forth. There's a lot yet to know.
And have we lagged behind because most of the researchers have been men, do you think?
I don't know so much if it was because they were men. Men are easier to study. I mean, if you want to study physiological arousal processes, it's it's right there.
Yes. You know? Pretty clear.
So you want to try that in women. There's still a tremendous debate and sometimes friendly, sometimes not so much about what we should be studying to even call a woman aroused these days.
So we'll get to that. But let's start with, I said that you started your research right after Viagra had been approved. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the climate in the scientific world at that time. What was going on?
We had had some period where, you know, we had sex therapies that were somewhat effective for a variety of different problems, and the same was true of erectile dysfunction. And I think normally we thought of new medical interventions as something that were adjunct. You know, you do that with relationship therapies or something. But Viagra was profoundly effective. I think it was a sea change immediately. And a lot of the things that kind of came with that were more than trying to solve what that means, you know, to redesigning a relationship that suddenly becomes sexual again, sometimes not by the partner's desire. So there was quite a lot that changed along with that, I think, in part because it was just the most effective intervention that we had seen in the sex domain.
So it sort of blew everything wide open.
It really blew everything away.
So then you got involved in a pioneering drug trial for a prototype that they hoped would become the Viagra for women. Tell us what happened.
You can imagine, in 1998, when Viagra came out, everyone started salivating at making the female drug. So ours was not the only lab. There were many, many pharmaceutical trials going on at that time, but they were all working on these PDE5 inhibitors.
These what?
A PDE5 inhibitor, which is the mechanism of Viagra and Cialis, all these agents. So they each had their own little tweak. Labs were trying slightly different variations, and they were effective. They all worked. They all increased vasocongestion just like they should have, and yet
when you
they
say,
failed miserably.
Let's define the terms. Mm-hmm. When you say vasocongestion,
so
which is?
This is, we measure this because we can, which is, we think increased blood in the vaginal walls. So in the same way that a man's penis fills with blood, the vaginal walls also fill with blood, and we can measure the opacity or how much the walls are translucent or not, and that we take as an indication of how congested the vaginal walls are. And it turns out women have those same kind of mechanisms around their vagina, and so the drugs do work in women in that sense. They do cause the same kind of relaxation that allows blood in that area.
But there's a but.
Then you ask the woman, how do you feel? And she says... So it was fascinating because that pattern, that disconnect between what women feel and what their vagina is doing, had been documented for decades. So I think many of us saw the direction the drug companies are going and said, oh, this is going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm. So you actually went to a conference at that time, mm-hmm. I'm recalling, where you were the only woman there, and this experience sort of soured you on Big Pharma. Why? What happened?
Absolutely. We had a trial that I was a graduate student at the time, and I was going to be their tech. I was going to do the signal processing. So you get a biological signal, you have to do something to it to be able to interpret it. So I was going to be their tech, and I went to this pharma meeting where it was, you know, physician at the drug company, my male advisor, and they talked about how women were.
Mm-hmm.
With great certainty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With me sitting in the corner saying, don't say anything, don't say anything, don't say anything. So now, of course, I would say something, but just basically the way largely pharma understood it, they had some concerns that had to do with not making the drug too effective.
Oh, because what would happen?
Roofie.
Ah.
So rape risk. Or that you would make a woman leave her husband.
Oh, because she'd become a nymphomaniac and
this
crazy.
This was the part of the discussion.
Oh, well, and you just sat there and kept your mouth shut through all of this? Pretty insulting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you decided that was the end of that sort of particular path for you at that point?
It was, what I didn't know at the time is it's very common in these types of trials that the scientists do not own the data. So if the data come out negatively, the companies just don't publish it.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened not just with our trial, but with many of them. So it was more of that component that I was like, wait a minute. So you mean we did all this mess and now we know this, but I can't tell anyone about kind of how things worked out.
So how they worked out, the women experienced the blood delivery to the vagina, mm-hmm. as you said, but they weren't experiencing orgasm. So why?
So they weren't even experiencing sexual arousal. They weren't even trying to go for orgasm.
Okay.
And we have done a lot of work to try and understand why that happens. You know, what's going on? That like, are we just measuring the wrong thing? Can we train women to be more coherent with that? We've tried doing vulvar temperature instead. Other labs have looked at clitoral engorgement or clitoral Doppler is another one we've tried. Thermographic cameras and thermistors, different ways of getting at temperature. So there's still a lot of work going into this. That is to understand why there's this disjoint. We still, I would say, don't generally know why, but it's a very well-replicated finding.
In part, though, it's because desire for women is as much psychological as physiological, right?
I always hesitate to say yes, but would say we often hear that distinction, say, oh, well, for guys, it's just so automatic. It's so easy for them. And I wouldn't say guys don't get off the hook. You know, they have these psychological processes, too. We don't know to what extent it's more mediated by that for men versus women. And so I don't want to paint it as like, the guys, they can get hard whenever they want and in whatever conditions. But it's certainly the case that there is something complex that we have not yet captured. for women.
Just a sidetrack here is the research you did showing that Viagra works on women too. Is that what you're talking about with the blood delivery? Or is there more to it than that? About how?
No, it was a whole series of labs, I think, that demonstrated that pretty effectively.
Yeah. Okay. So how do you measure desire? How do you measure that?
Nobody knows. Historically, we've done it with questionnaires.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we ask questions like, how often in the last week of a typical month have you thought about sex with desire? And then on a 1 to 7 scale, you tell us.
And what is the research? How does the research go? What have you learned? Are we progressing in understanding this?
I think desire-wise, our measures are still pretty bad. Most mm-hmm. people still rely just on self-report. And you can imagine, like, that is impinged on by all kinds of other things, you know, the way you feel about your partner, maybe your mood at the time. So we really, I think, need something more objective, you know, a physiological indicator. And arousal is different from desire, so I don't think any amount of genital futzing is gonna fix or answer that desire question. So mm-hmm. part of what we're doing is trying to look more central, that is, look at the brain response. So that may be one way to look at it.
Tell us about Adye, am I saying mm-hmm. that right? So this is the first drug that was approved by the FDA to treat low sexual desire in women. I want to know about its effectiveness, the side effects, and where are we with this drug? I'd never heard of it before I started reading about you and your work. So mm-hmm. what's going on with that?
So there was one female intervention approved before Adye. It was a clitoral pump that looks shockingly like sex toys that you might see on the tables outside. I don't know how they got FDA approval, but Adye has an interesting story because it kind
Wait, the clitoral pump.
Yes.
So how far did that get? I mean, was that...
It's FDA approved for sexual arousal disorder in women.
Are people selling it? Are people buying it?
So if you go to the pleasure show or one of these centers, I think they've seen, you know, $10, $15 range.
Like Good Vibrations?
Good Vibrations. Uh-huh. Thank you.
One of our media sponsors, not media sponsors, but one of the supporters and partners for our program, we love them, shop there. Go ahead.
But if you go to a physician and they prescribe it for you, that device is $540.
Oh.
Yeah.
Does it work?
It claims to bring blood into the clitoris, and it does exactly that. It's a pump.
Uh-huh.
So it's highly effective. And so Adye came about kind of a funny way, just like Viagra did. So, you know, Viagra, they weren't developing a penis drug. They were developing a cardiovascular drug and noticed it had this really nice side effect. And similarly, Adye was being developed as an antidepressant. And they noticed some people seeming to report pro-sexual effects, but they weren't very strong. And so it took them ultimately 3 approaches with the FDA before they were approved. And there's a lot of debate around whether that approval was appropriate or not. And it's exactly the kind of questions you ask. So the effect of the drug is there. I mean, FDA wouldn't approve it if there wasn't evidence for that.
So you take this drug and mm-hmm. you feel arousal, desire, you're in the mood. Is that what happens?
No, it's a chronic use drug. You take it every day for the rest of your life.
Yeah, yeah. And so, wow.
That's what we said.
Okay, and but if you take it every day for the rest of your life, which sounds really expensive, and who's going to do that, it works. What about side effects?
The main one is they had some problems with fainting. But if you don't drink alcohol, it turns out that is not so much of a risk. So when you agree to take the prescription for the drug, you have to also agree to never consume alcohol again.
Ever?
Ever.
Wait, okay, so let me back up here. So suppose I decide I am interested in this mm-hmm. for now, and I want to take the drug for like a month. Am I going to be sexually turned on and successful in achieving orgasm and all of this for a month? I mean, could I do that?
You could try. So I haven't seen a lot of data about kind of the introduction efficacy, you know, how long it takes before you start to see a actual effect from it over time. We can guess from other antidepressants it's probably going to take a few weeks. Mm-hmm. And then it's not acute like Viagra. So it's something that, you know, they think kind of builds up. It's not like you pop one and then, you know, it's kind of a slow burn, if you will.
And probably like other drugs for depression, if you stop taking it all of a sudden, it's probably not a good idea. But you are suggesting a link between low sexual desire, low libido, and depression.
No one talks about this very openly. It's pretty surprising. But yeah, I mean, if that was the direction it was being developed, and this is the outcome they're claiming, how much are we really talking about low desire? Or are we talking about depression and mood problems that are not being addressed?
So you have tools that you use. So many tools for sexual stimulation as part of your research, mm-hmm. To measure, as you say, these responses in women. Tell us about some of these tools and the measurements you use.
So there's kind of two broad classes. We have stimulators and instruments that tend to measure the response. So amongst stimulators, we use everything from asking people to fantasize on demand. So like, start, mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. It turns out that's kind of hard to do. We use lots of porn. Those are heavily pre-tested to be effective for the samples that we're using them in. And very, very vanilla.
When you use porn, it's mm-hmm. a reward task kind of thing. How does that work?
We've done that too. Yeah. So the reward task we like to do with vibrators, actually. So I think we're still the only lab in the U.S. that's using vibrators where you play a game. This little square comes on the screen, and you have to hit the button while the square is still on the screen. If you do that fast enough, then you get rewarded by seconds of vibrator to your genitals. So it comes
this
on.
This is in your lab?
Yes.
Okay.
So, right, this is one way that we look at sexual motivation and try and separate out the idea of the anticipation of it happening mm-hmm. to then actually receiving the sexual mm-hmm. reward when the vibrator actually comes on.
And you were doing this at UCLA, mm-hmm. and how was... Wait, let's get it... Before we get into that and what happened there, what other tools do you use?
So the most common one in our field by far is called a vaginal photoplethysmograph. And if you've ever been to the doctor and had them put that thing on your finger, that's a plethysmograph. Mm-hmm. So it's just...
Say that word again.
Plethysmograph.
Plethysmograph. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I know I always make my undergrad say it five times fast. So like, you will learn to pronounce this. It's a very simple tampon-shaped acrylic device that goes into the vagina. It sends light out. It used to be an incandescent light, so you'd be like shoving a Christmas light up there. It's changed, so now it's an LED. But it measures how much light comes back to the device, and we take that to be a measure of how much blood is in the vaginal walls.
Mm-hmm. So, and you also yourself developed an anal pressure gauge, right? Is that like, did you patent it? I mean, tell us about that and how that works.
So the last time someone really studied the contractions associated with orgasm was in the early 80s. So there's not just like some device you can go around and like buy off the shelf, like, oh, I'd like one anal pressure gauge, please, you know? So we also were trying to use this in the fMRI environment, which doesn't allow metal.
What environment?
Functional magnetic resonance imaging is a device to look at activation in the brain. And you can't have metal in that environment because mm-hmm. it's driven by large magnets. So... we ended up developing two of these devices. I say we, this is my colleague Greg Siegel at University of Pittsburgh and I. One of which is basically has an air pocket in the neck of what looks like a butt plug. Mm-hmm. So when the anus contracts, then the air is displaced, and we take that as a measure of contraction. And then the other device outside of the fMRI environment, we just use a more simple electromyography, or EMG, and that's just a measure of muscle tonicity. So much simpler.
So what are all these measurements, where are they leading you? Are they, because you're hoping to find some answers, and what mm-hmm. exactly is it that you're hoping they tell you?
I think, you know, we've been studying orgasm officially like as a sex research field for decades, but people make very strong claims about, you know, multi-orgasmic and G-spot this and blah, 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 you know, all these types of things without ever making sure that people are actually having an orgasm. And it turns out when we look, many of them are not mm-hmm. when they think they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how does a woman herself know for sure?
This Seriously. Is the goal, yes, the $5,000 question.
Because I think many women are unsure.
I think beyond just the Harry Met Sally, when they're consciously aware that they are not, that there is some proportion, we have no idea how many women this affects, who think that they are when in fact physiologically they are not.
So there is a precise measure that says when this mm-hmm. happens physiologically,
yes.
you are having an orgasm. And that's what these tools are measuring.
There are very stereotyped contractions that only occur in that particular pattern at orgasm.
Okay. Okay. You're listening to neuroscientist and sexual psychophysiologist Nicole Prousy on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Your newest study involves something called transcranial magnetic stimulation. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that is and how that works.
So TMS is a device that is not electroshock therapy. It's kind of the newer permutation of that. And it just gets a little bit into the brain. It can't go very deep, but you use these coils that are outside of the head, and we use different ways of guiding that to place it over the area of the brain that we want to stimulate. And when I say stimulate, depending on what pattern you use, you can either increase the activity of that particular brain area, or you can decrease it. But it'll only go so deep. So we're talking probably a few millimeters, depending who you ask. So this has been an amazing resource for people who have treatment-resistant depression. That's what it's most widely used for. And now TMS is being developed for many, many different problems. So kind of OCD has gotten some attention. Other anxiety disorders, people are looking at it for PTSD, for Parkinson's, and the applications, depending on where you stimulate or what type of pattern you use with that stimulation, seem to vary.
Does this alter your brain permanently?
It can.
Ooh, that sounds like a pretty serious... So would you use this for somebody who just kind of sort of wanted to have orgasms? Or, I mean, this sounds very serious.
Sure. So the way that it's thought to work is basically to normalize that particular function or dysregulated area of the brain. So what that means is if you're someone who kind of has normal drive, but you want to be super drive woman or, you know, like super orgasmic... that we probably can't do that with TMS if you're already functioning at kind of a normal, quote-unquote, level. So, you know, it's nothing that we can hyperdrive. But if you're someone who is low responsiveness, there's reason to think it could be effective in helping those folks.
How many of these kinds of treatments would you have to, for it to be effective?
So in depression, they have a series usually of like 8 to 12, and there are lots of tests going on these days to see how close you can pack those. The stimulations themselves are just a couple of minutes. That's mm-hmm. it. And it does have a risk of seizure, but it's very, very uncommon.
Wait, okay. So are we talking about, have we identified a specific region of the brain that we're trying to stimulate that mm-hmm. is specific to sexual desire?
Sure. So the most common area stimulated in depression is called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, or the DLPFC. Usually they do it on the left side. And we have reason to think that's the same type of area that's impacted in low drive. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're trying as well.
So would you do this yourself? Have this transcript?
I don't want to mess up my drive. It's fine how it is.
But, you know, I know that scientists often will...
Yes.
Undergo whatever it is.
I feel a bit guilty because this is really the first protocol that I have just refused to do to myself. Mm-hmm. Everything else, if you do it in my lab, it's because I tried it and I didn't die.
Except for this.
Except for this.
So Overall, how is research into sexuality marginalized? Because I understand you believe that it has been and continues to be.
Sure. It's not even a hinted or one of these things, oh, is it, is it not? So when I was a student, we had four grants that were brought up before Congress for defunding. They were all sexuality grants that had been, you know, peer approved, reviewed appropriately. And it was just because of the sexual content. In the history of the National Institutes of Health, only one grant has ever been defunded. It was a sex grant.
Is that because of some puritanical streak?
Strictly.
And is that unique to this country?
Yes. So Canada, I've been heavily recruited in Canada. They actually have a female sexuality research division.
Mm-hmm. You mean here, the government of Canada?
Yeah.
Or really?
Yeah, and if you do that here, you can lose your job.
Wow. And what about elsewhere in Europe, Asia, the rest of the world?
Yeah, much more open. So some, depending on the country, have more initiatives that are specific in that area. Some are just agnostic. But.
And are they making greater strides as a result of the better funding?
Hell yes.
Yeah?
It is very frustrating to try and do this work in this country because it's, you know, you will be just openly attacked for even trying to do it. There's a very high professional risk. You know, mm-hmm. Even if you're successful in getting these grants, you can have them taken away potentially. You know, in submitting them, they'll tell you all these tricks as to how to like edit the word sexual out of your application that is about sexual functioning.
Wow, really?
Overtly.
So when you were Liberos is no longer housed at UCLA, is that correct?
Correct.
When you were doing your work at UCLA and doing the kind of stimulation and things you've talked about tonight, mm-hmm. how were you received and how was that work received at UCLA?
So we have the distinction of having the second protocol in the history of the school that's ever been rejected. And
who,
it was
who by whom?
By the ethics board. So whenever you want to do research in humans, basically it needs to be approved by an institutional review board or an IRB. And they review a variety of things related to subject safety, consent, you know, making sure that, you know, anyone who walks in the door is protected adequately. And it's a, you know, something we all have to do, and we hope that they are operating under their professional guidelines and just consider those items. In this particular case, we are trying to start a study of orgasm. And I say we, this is the lab in Pittsburgh and UCLA. We're going to have two sites, both collecting data. The Pittsburgh approved no problem. UCLA said, if you don't take out the orgasm component, we won't let you do it here.
Well, what were the other components?
They were all things we had done previously.
I see.
Vibrator stimulation of the genitals was fine, but no orgasm.
Really?
Yeah.
So did you kind of turn on your heel and storm out?
I am embarrassed by some of the emails. Because, we were just like, wait, what? Are you serious? We kept trying, of course, to get answers. But as a young investigator, it's very difficult, you know, in your early career to say, well, you can't do that to me. And they're like, well, yeah we can.
Yeah, so that's why you formed your own company.
Yes.
Is that correct? And so how are you funded now?
So we have research contracts that are funding us. We do research on orgasmic meditation. We have some contracts.
Wait, what's that? Orgasmic meditation.
That's what I asked when someone first told me. I said, hold up. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's kind of like a yoga practice for your clitoris.
Okay.
So there are several groups in the country now that are doing this, which I didn't realize. And it's a partnered practice where the stroker and strokee work together. And the woman is always being stroked. The stroker could be male or female, or otherwise, I suppose. And they have this whole regimented 15-minute practice where the stroker is stimulating the genitals of the strokee. And when I first heard that, I said, okay, that's weird, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, oh my God, that's the perfect research protocol. How can I get in the door? Because, you know, no one's done partnered stimulation research since Masters and Johnson. Mm-hmm. It's not been allowed in this country. And I said, I just walked out of that door. I can do this now. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we make this happen? And so we've just started that.
And how do you get people in your lab to do it? Do you advertise for them? How do you get people? Seriously.
For this particular one, it's funny. People often ask that question. They say, how do you get volunteers? I say, we have to turn them away. Have you seen our protocols? It depends on the study. So we've done everything from we've advertised in the casual encounter section of Craigslist. Very effective area to advertise.
Because you pay people.
Do you pay people? Pay people to come in and mm-hmm. have an orgasm, tell us how it went.
There are people like buying tickets to LA right now. Yeah. I'm going there.
And so with the.
Do you use people of all ages, by the way?
18.
Yeah, 18. Well. Yeah. But I mean, don't do you use elderly people?
Oh, sure. So it depends on the study again, but we often do cut off with menopause, and because that occurs somewhere around the age of 65, we'll often cut it off at 65 for men as well, if we're including men. Mm-hmm. And the reasoning there is just so much changes that if you want to study that age group, you really need something that's directed to address it appropriately. Mm-hmm. And we're not always set up to do that. It depends mm-hmm. on the nature of the question.
Mm-hmm. So there's been a reaction. There was a reaction at UCLA. You've now been out there. There have been articles about you. You've been exposed in the media. Do you get people personally reacting to the work you're doing? And who are they? Who are those? And not specifically who are they, but what kind of person is really offended, upset with the work you're doing?
So it turns out people are not too upset about the orgasm part of it. People seem pretty happy about orgasms, mm-hmm. which is why I love this research so much. But definitely other research we've done in this area, especially things that suggest porn might not be all bad all the time.
Porn might not be all bad. Mm-hmm. So the anti-pornography people.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Huge target on my back. Mm-hmm. And that's, I say broadly, it's three groups. These are people who treat sex and porn addiction. The therapists are very, very unhappy with our research.
Why?
Because it should suggest that porn isn't addicting, and it's usually right on the name of their center. It's like Center for Sex Addiction Treatment.
So, do you believe that there is no such thing as sexual addiction?
No, I don't believe it's an addiction.
Okay.
Doesn't mean it's not a problem, but it's not an addiction.
Okay, interesting. And some people are going to 12-step programs and very invested in that idea.
Paying several thousand dollars for inpatient programs when it's not even a diagnosis, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So for most women who aren't having orgasms all the time and who would like to be having more mm-hmm. and would like to be having a more satisfying sexual relationship with their partner or with a number of partners, what do you tell them? Like what's the story for them? What is there in all of this research and what you're doing that can be helpful and useful mm-hmm. to people who aren't involved in studies and taking drugs every day and all that kind of stuff?
So I think in general, anorgasmia or difficulty having orgasm, we actually have really pretty effective treatments for. These are kind of psychoeducational treatments that have been around since the late 70s thereabouts. But usually where they break down is we're pretty good at getting women to be able to have an orgasm by themselves.
With a vibrator.
With a vibrator, with their hand. So getting that to actually transfer to the experience with their partner, which is usually why they're there in the first place, we suck at. Mm-hmm. We are not very good at kind of getting that final stage that they're really requesting usually when they come in for that kind of treatment. So I don't know, like the TMS work that we're doing with the brain stimulation.
That's the transcranial stimulation.
The other types of brain stimulation we're doing as well. I think, frankly, they're unlikely to be helpful for orgasm. Time will tell. We certainly will ask. But we know so little about how that response gets triggered. And even if we had a sense, we now have a good idea that when we were looking at triggers, when other labs asked about triggers, what people were reporting was probably inaccurate.
Inaccurate.
So I think we're going to be rewriting the last few decades of research.
Well, Dan Savage was here recently. I don't know how many of our audience members were here for that. Yeah. He's pretty great. And there was a question about achieving orgasm with a partner. Mm-hmm. And he said, use a vibrator. I mean, so that's perfectly acceptable and so forth. But what you're saying is, people still want to achieve it with their partner without any
even with a vibrator, they can't make that jump. So I totally hear what he's saying. Like, if that gets you there, and then it wouldn't be a problem with a partner, and you're just shy, well, sure. But our data suggests it's not a matter of being shy. Whatever is happening is really prohibiting that transfer. So maybe it's something psychological extra that kicks in. We don't know.
Do you see any new drug coming along other than this Aggie for women? Is there anything on the horizon?
Sure. There are lots of dopaminergic drugs, but the balance there...
What does that word mean?
So anything that acts
increases
primarily on dopamine.
Like
cocaine? Yeah.
Cocaine. And you are not suggesting...
Yeah. So this is the problem. People say, where's the sex drug for desire? I say, well, we've got plenty that work. Yeah. It's just the problem is they're addictive.
And illegal and, yeah.
Whatever. So I think a lot of the challenge has been trying to find something that's dopaminergic, like, well, Butrin is a more dopaminergically acting antidepressant. It has more pro-sexual side effects, including shortened orgasm latency. So there's certainly reason to think if we can find something that can act more in a dopaminergic way, that it's likely to be effective, but we have to find a way to do that, balancing those concerns for, you know, its potential addictive properties, if that's some of the systems it's hitting.
Do you think in the next decade we'll see that?
I would be surprised if we don't. There are so many things that are kind of stage three now that something else is coming along, and I feel bad, Ad, you kind of took the wind out of their sails.
But. Yeah. Masters of Sex, the TV show, which takes place at Kinsey Institute, right? Is that?
No. It's Masters and Johnson. We're in Chicago.
Masters and Johnson. What do you think of that? Is that pretty right on, realistic? I think they're going into their next season, but it hasn't started yet.
Yeah, this was really funny experience. So I was at UCLA in part while that series was running, and nothing has changed. My students would come in, and like when we got word that study had been rejected, and I had to tell all my research assistants that their work was not going to be used after all, they said, oh my God, this just happened on the show. I said, what? What show? And they said, Masters and Johnson's lab just got shut down. I was like, sorry.
Yeah.
History repeats itself.
So I see you have this scar on your knee, and I happen to know that you're a big drag racer. Is this true? And fire spinner, I don't even know what that is, but is this a drag racing injury?
This was a Hollywood Boulevard late at night motorcycle road rash.
Okay, but you're a daredevil, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think
just
that
trying
counts.
To figure out the whole picture here, and... It's pretty fascinating.
The dopamine's going.
Yeah.
I got it.
Absolutely. What is a fire spinner?
I love to win in Rome, you know, so wherever area I've moved into to find what they've got there. And it turns out there are a lot of performers in LA.
And there are a lot of waiters. Performers, yes.
So indeed, Hollywood has a place where you can actually go learn to blow fire, just like the circus. Spin fire. And
spinning fire? What does that mean?
So I was a twirler when I was in high school, and they would never let me light the damn things. So I said, this is it. It was destined. It's down the street.
So it's like twirling with fire.
You can do a baton. You can do a staff. You can do fans. You can do poi. You can light anything on fire and then just spin it around.
So, and this is a nice Midwestern girl? Is that what
Texas.
From? Texas. Yeah. And look what happened. Anyway.
Sorry,
Dad. Really
Dad.
Glad you're here to share all of this with us and enlighten us. And what we're going to do now is bring up the house lights, and we have microphones. So if you have a question, and please do not be shy. You're probably not shy if you're here. We're ready. And I think there's one right here in the front.
Hi. So I know, you know, some women have a hard time achieving orgasms, and, you know, there's clitoral orgasm or vaginal orgasm. Are there other type of orgasms? And like, do you look at both of them together separately and
good
such?
Question. I am so excited to myth bust here. Let me add them. So first of all, this is totally over-righteous PC, so I apologize. Sex therapists work so hard not to say achieve orgasm, experience orgasm. It's not an achievement, y'all. But so the idea that different sources of stimulation may, when you say clitoral and vaginal, so you could be talking about the source of the orgasm, what caused it, or it could be the experience. So some people say, you know, I have orgasms that are generated by clitoral stimulation, but then I experience them vaginally. It turns out physiologically, there's no evidence for that. So we have never been able to find a pattern that say, oh, that looks vaginal. That was a vaginal orgasm, because we just never bothered to verify it in general. That said, many people report, and we have published many people reporting orgasms from, for example, nipple stimulation. So they say that alone is enough. But no one ever verified that that person was actually having a physiological orgasm. So who knows if that's real or not? There are lots of reports of that type of thing. And also, for instance, in people who end up with spinal cord injuries, they talk about the transference of sexual sensitivity to different areas of the body when they can no longer directly sense their genitals. But there's just, I think, not been good work done to verify that that's really what's happening. And lots of mythology around it.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features neuroscientist and sexual psychophysiologist Nicole Prousey. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You say that you have a definition of orgasm. It has to do with contractions you can measure. Where do those contractions occur?
And the vaginal and anal sphincter is usually the places they're measured.
Okay, so this is kind of a problem that I have with orgasm. The idea of, and it is, you know, sort of like in the achieving orgasm. I mean, is that necessarily what everybody...
Who's to say, is what you're saying.
Sure. So I can answer that in two ways. So some people are distinguishing between orgasm and climax. So people may say, you know, the psychological experience or heightened part is a climax. And in fact, my co-author made this argument. He said, you can't say those women are having orgasms. That's mean. Well, hey, it ain't mean if it's true.
Mean?
Yes. This is the guy is telling me not to be mean to women. So, because we're trying to figure out, you know, how to write about this result in our papers and things. So I think that's one thing, is some people do make that distinction, and they say you might have many climaxes that are just kind of peak experiences that don't necessarily associate with contractions, and that those should be valued too. So that's one way to kind of approach it. And let me think.
I think that question was really interesting, because it was about sort of a quantification value. This is... you know, labeling, and that's a really interesting question.
Yeah, so the other piece of that, and we're the first lab I know of to really follow the sexual response all the way through, that is from starting stimulation through an orgasm-reported experience, and monitor the brain, and what we're seeing, and EEG is the only thing that, electroencephalography, that brain measure, is the only thing that really has good enough time resolution to be able to see some of this progression, is what we think is the reward signal in a part of that brain response does not spike at orgasm. It's before. And not at the initiation, before. So what that suggests to me is most of the reward in the interaction may not even be coming from the orgasm. It could be that's just a physiological event that happens at the end for some other purpose. And of course, there are many, many books that kind of debate what is the function of orgasm in women? Why do we still have that? Is it vestigial? Something else? I don't know, but we are working on trying to decipher those data, and it could very well be that the main reward actually comes from very high arousal states, not the orgasm itself.
I can actually say that there's a...
Is that Carol?
Yeah, it's
Will
Carol.
Will you identify yourself, please?
I'm Carol Queen. I'm with the Center for Sex and Culture and the staff sexologist at Good Vibrations.
And the creator of the Antique Vibrator Museum.
And the curator of the Antique Vibrator Museum, and I'm so happy to be able to participate in this wonderful series. Thank you. What I'd like to ask you to talk about a little bit more, Nicole, is this question of arousal. Because it seems to me, when we're talking to people who are disappointed with their sex lives at Good Vibrations, and when we hear anecdotally, when I answer questions at Bust Magazine, loads and loads of women seem to think that they should be achieving orgasm with vaginal intercourse, which does happen, but is rare comparatively. And one of the things that I think isn't well understood is the degree to which you've got to factor in the time it takes to get optimally aroused, whatever that means, and the time that many people are actually taking having sex. I don't know if you've tried to quantify any of that. If you have tried, I'd love to hear how that has gone. But just your thoughts on this question, because the relationship of arousal and orgasm, it seems to me, is pretty distinct. It's at least anecdotally understood. And it's hard to teach people about high arousal if they've only gone as far as they have gone. Mm-hmm. Your scientific thoughts, so welcome.
I'm going to answer with non-terribly scientific thoughts to start, actually, because, like I said, we test everything on our self first. And so there was a time when I had to go through this vibrator protocol as we were setting it up to make sure it did what it was supposed to do, because no one had ever tried to automate that process before. And so, you know, at first we're like, well, I don't even know how long the thing should be on. Should we turn it on and off? Should we, like, do one of these? You know, there's this whole teledildonics field. Don't Google that at work. And that they have speculations about what that should be. So as I'm going through these protocols, you know, I'm collecting these data to try and look at markers of stimulation patterns and trying to develop a lab protocol. And my collaborator at the time, who, you know, never in the room, always in a separate space monitoring outcomes and physio data, said, "Oh my God, what happened? Is everything okay?" He said, Yeah. Do you realize how consistent you are?" I said, "What?" He said, "You were like exactly, like within 5 seconds every time you've done this protocol." I said, "Are you serious? Really?" So I don't think that there's anything special or vertical about my body in particular, but what that told me is, you know, there may be some period for which a particular person, like, this is just their set point. That is, you need thus and such a time period, even if it's just you and your friendly manual chosen method. So, but that process, we know nothing about, because in the lab, we really, we're either setting very short arousal processes. Our films rarely go beyond 5 minutes. Usually they're 3 minutes, nowhere near what you need. And the few labs that study orgasm throughout the world, what they usually do is they give the woman a room. They may give her some toy options. Usually they say they can bring stuff from home, and they say, "Let me know." They measure nothing. And I think that's horrible. But what that means is when people have these very basic questions, like, well, how long should it take? Like, how long should I be waiting there? You know, before something kicks in, or I say, okay, that's good enough, like, let's give up. I have nothing to tell them. There are no normative data. You know, from my N of one, there's some suggestion there may be a set point for individuals, and there are probably some informal data out there from these teledildonic folks that would be fascinating to tap into, and now maybe I have a chance since I've got a little more testing freedom. But yeah, it's a really disappointing answer. I'm sorry.
But would you say, by and large, I mean, I know you're not in the advice business, you would tell people to slow down?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the, yeah, people say, you ever have any advice, it's always slow down. It takes longer than you think. But I would say that's probably, it probably takes longer than you think. You know, mm-hmm. We don't really have any kind of hard method, time period to recommend that.
Right.
I really wish we did.
Yeah.
In terms of the research, what qualities tend to be most, I guess, indicative of that an orgasm will come? Like, is it a sense of intimacy with a partner, or mystery, or admiration? Is there research on that?
I'm trying to think, like, research on who's most likely to be orgasmic. I saw a French paper on this, and I'm trying to remember what all was in there. We know very little about the partner in this respect, which I think is kind of interesting.
So that is like what features of the partner could be supportive of that experience. I really don't have any clue. We do know there are lots of correlates of orgasm, whether these are just part and parcel or causative, I don't know. But things like general sensation seeking, so people that, I don't know, like to ride motorcycles.
Wait, say that again? I missed
general
that.
Sensation seeking.
General so, sensation seeking.
Yeah, people who just like having visceral experiences also seem to be more prone to orgasm. People, there's been one study looking at the heritability of orgasm, so how if there's a genetic component, so to speak, orgasm is heritable.
It is.
Yes. This is certainly not a U.S. study, but...
But and because your parents don't necessarily share that information with you.
So you have to go overseas where they... There are some countries where they collect these basic types of health data from their citizens writ large, and they even let them ask them sex questions. It's so terrible. but one of the things that came out of that is someone noticed there was an orgasm question. They happened to be a geneticist. And so, oh, well, you know, we can analyze that. It doesn't look like the heritability component's very strong, but it is there. So there may be something there. Physiologically, we can talk about that. So there's a study where they looked at the distance between the vaginal opening and the clitoris, and it turns out how far those are apart also is determinant. So the closer the clitoris, that is the bulb of the clitoris, is to the vaginal opening, the more likely the person is to experience orgasm and experience orgasm during intercourse. So, which we're assuming is because there's more clitoral stimulation because it ain't from the vagina. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are the things that come to mind off the top.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I'm thinking about something you touched on earlier, which is, yes, it feels good, but what actually, in evolutionary view, is the purpose of orgasm? And I was thinking about cross species. Like, for example, the bonobo, as we know, have a great time all the time. And, in fact, I mean, one of the important things about orgasm, as far as we know, is women hang in there, or other female species, so that there's reproduction as a result. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, has your research or reading or whatever dealt with, like, you know, what were Neanderthal orgasms like?
Yeah.
Or of course, you can't know. But for example, but the bonobo, for one, they certainly like having sex, and I guess they're all having orgasms.
Well, this is a very interesting point. I wish we had good animal models of orgasm, but we don't really know female animals that have orgasms to study. So there's been a lot of debate within humans as to exactly like what is the function. And one I think I mentioned could be vestigial, that is, women were never meant to have orgasms. For instance, there's a question as to, can all women even have them? Like, is it possible that it partially evolved out of some women? That's a possibility. Some people say it's just a kind of discharge. So because you get so vasocongested with sexual arousal, men do as well. And when they're done, they don't want to be walking around with an erection. So something has to get the blood all back out. You know, in their case, it's from releasing the tension that allows it to flow back out of the penis. But then what about the vagina in that area? Some people say maybe that's the function of orgasm, is it's really just kind of flushing the blood back into the rest of the body because it doesn't need to be all in the vagina anymore. And then, to your actual question, which is like, what about the pleasure? So is there something about that experience that bonds people together? There are a number of people looking at what we think. One study looking at what we think is oxytocin, vasopressin, and some other stuff surge that seems to occur at orgasm. You know, and is there something about the bonding then, you know, some kind of tertiary effect that may be useful for binding people together when they have good sexual experiences together? Sky's the limit. I have no idea for Neanderthals, and I think a big part of the limitations here is we can't test it in animals.
Interesting.
My question is general, but it's about if you've conducted any research about vulvodynia and what you know about pain during intercourse as it relates to pelvic floor tightness.
I have to ask her to you to define these terms because you're talking about the talus.
Sure. So people broadly call like dyspareunia just means pain during sex, and vulvodynia, vulvar vestibulitis being the most common forms, they refer to pain in specific areas of the vulva. And so by far the most common area of pain during intercourse is this little flap of skin that somebody made a really dumb design choice here. Let me tell you, this really thin flap of skin just at the bottom of the introitus that gets irritated when like any woman has sex. There's always tearing associated with intercourse, and that particular area gets irritated. I've only done one study related to sex pain, and it had to do with penis size, so I wouldn't claim myself to be much of an expert in that. Turns out penis size of the partner isn't much related to sexual pain, which is kind of interesting. But there is some really cool science in this area that I think is interesting to follow. They did this study like 10 years ago where they compared different treatment methods, so cognitive behavioral therapy, physical therapy, and then excising the dermis of the vulva, so literally cutting the skin out. And that was by far the most effective intervention. And, you know, those of us that are psychologists are like, oh, God, like that sounds terrible. And why? Because if we look, people don't consistently see redness erythema, that is, in this area. So women say, like, it hurts like crazy, but we can't see anything wrong. And they found in this animal model that if you give these poor little rats some repeated yeast infections, that even when the infection is completely cleared, you can find no evidence for it. Those that have a history of repeated candidus infections continue to have vulvar pain. And one of the best predictors of VVS in women is repeated history of candidus infections. So what I think is probably going on in most of these cases is, not all, but you know, in some proportion, is that there's some history of maybe it's candidus, maybe it's some other insult to that area, and it means you don't necessarily see anything wrong with the skin, but it's still in some way hypersensitized. And one way is to address that is potentially to remove that sensitized skin. I really hope there's a better way, because it sounds kind of brutal. But that's my sense, is kind of the leading edge right now, is trying to understand, you know, what is it that we're that seems to be happening in that skin that we might be able to actually identify it to say you are experiencing the type of pain that would benefit from the surgery. Hmm. Because we don't just want to start putting women through it.
So a couple things here. We had a meeting this afternoon. We were talking about whether we should have questions on cards tonight, because would our audience be too shy to ask questions? Well, it's so wonderful. Thank you all, because these were great questions, and I certainly learned a lot from what you asked. And clearly, if your children are going to grow up to be scientists, or you're a young person, this is a great field. And Nicole Prousey, thank you so much for the work you do, and thanks for being
thank
here
you for
tonight.
The question.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was neuroscientist and sexual psychophysiologist Nicole Prousey. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espolay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.